This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and now to my guest, Dr. Ray McInnes. He's up in Richmond, British Columbia. We're going to talk about the unanswered and ignored questions 9/11 families asked to the 9/11 Commission. Yes, the anniversary of 9/11 has passed, but I felt that we learned absolutely nothing new and important from all of the discussion in the media. I believe that this was just another orchestrated focus that we move on. Nothing to see here. Ray says, hold on a second. There's a lot to see. Who is Ray McInnes? He is a writer, author, private researcher living in British Columbia. He's the author of a recent book, Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored, which is the result of a dozen years of personal research to investigate the efforts of the Family Steering Committee and the other family members of 9/11 victims and first responders to pressure the government for transparent and accountable inquiry into the causal effects of the attack on the World Trade Center. Ray is also the author of Writing the Sacred, which presents the power of stories, narratives, and poems for expressing a sense of the sacred. His website is unansweredquestions.ca. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Oh, great to be with you, Gary.
There are many independent investigators, they're growing in numbers, who have called for challenging the official 9/11 Commission narrative since shortly after the event. However, there are the families of almost 3,000 people who died at the towers and another 6,000 who were seriously injured. Also, there are victims of the catastrophe that are in the general population because of the pollution that occurred. It was incumbent upon the government to conduct a thorough, independent, objective investigation into the evidence leading to the event. As a national tragedy with consequences that went well beyond the loss of lives, it was demanded that government investigations should be completely open. The American public wanted and deserved answers, and especially the families who lost loved ones. In many respects, the families had far more incentive to do their own research to investigations than the usual names of people in the 9/11 truth movement. One important difference is that the families were permitted to directly interact with the commission by forming a family steering committee. On the other hand, the independent critics of the truth movement were outside the circle. Therefore, they had the opportunity to directly provide questions for the 9/11 Commission to address and try to answer. In addition, the Bush administration did everything it could to prevent and stall a commission from being organized. It was largely by means of a family's efforts that the commission was started a year later. Yet the vast majority of the family's questions were never answered. Many were categorically ignored, and that remains the case 20 years later. More or less, the government, in a way, was applying the Fifth Amendment for itself. And your research has been focusing on the efforts that families made to have their questions answered. So please begin by painting a picture of this group of family members who organized to go to Washington and, and pressure the government and our legislators to undertake a proper investigation.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's an interesting group of people. There were, in the aftermath of the catastrophe, people initially were, families were going to funerals, and then there was a bill in Congress, I think in September of 2001, about $15 billion bailout bill for the airlines, United and American. And in the middle of that discussion in Congress, somebody in Congress floor said, hey, wait a minute, we better give the families something too, or else this isn't going to look very good. So suddenly there was something created called the Victims Compensation Fund. And families were, sent communications, I think, by mail from the government to get together, to go to some halls and hear from government lawyers about what the Victims Compensation Fund would be. And those gatherings were a catalyst for family members to first see each other in these gatherings. They're all strangers, many of them, from one another. They might have people that they knew that worked together, husbands that worked together, etc., but they might not even have known each other. But when they got to those Victims Compensation Fund gatherings, then people like Carrie Lemack started forming the Families of September 11th, the FOS group. And then there was Monica Gabrielle and Sally Regenhardt formed the Skyscraper Safety Campaign. And then Kristen Breitweiser, Lori Van Auken, Mindy Kleinberg, and Patty Casaza, known as the Jersey Girls, formed the September 11th Advocates. And there were other groups as well. Mary Fetchett and Beverly Eckert that also ended up in the Family Steering Committee were part of Voices of September 11th out of Connecticut. And so you have actually several dozens of different family groups forming, but eventually they coalesced. There was a rally on the 11th of June 2002, and there were about 300 family members. There was also, I think, Senator Joe Lieberman from Connecticut. I know John McCain from Arizona, Republican, was also involved in supporting the families at that point. And then there was incredible pressure. At that point, I think, in the late spring, summer of 2002, the Family Steering Committee really formed with people being named to sort of represent other large family groups that represented hundreds, even thousands of people. And Kristen Breitweiser and a number of others went on Chris Matthews Hardball in late August, decrying the lack of movement on the part of the government. Vice President Dick Cheney had been saying he objected to having any investigation because he couldn't afford the resources. It'd be a distraction during the war on terror. And so, there was this big, interview, and it was a catalyst for her, Kristen Breitweiser, speaking before the joint 9/11 inquiry of the Senate and Congress Intelligence Committees on the 18th of September 2002. And her testimony was riveting. And so that was a huge catalyst for then pressure. And one of the people in the White House said that there was a train coming and nothing could stop it. So by late November, President Bush signed legislation to have an investigation. And as soon as he did that, he named Dr. Henry Kissinger to head up the investigation. And Kristen Breitweiser, who just had a two-year-old but had previously learned to was a lawyer, did some background checking about him, and a number of other families did too. And so when they met with him in his very ritzy office up in Manhattan, Lori Van Auken was the one, I think, who Dr. Kissinger was serving the family members, about these dozen people, coffee and treats. And as he was serving coffee, she said, "Dr. Kissinger, we just want to make sure that there's no conflict of interest and that you don't have any clients by the name of Bin Laden." And as she asked the question, he started to spill coffee all over the coffee table, onto the carpet, nearly fell off the couch, and blamed it on a fake eye. And all the women mostly are running around trying to get paper towels to clean things up, but going, "What was that?" And the next morning, he resigned. And so then they had Lee Hamilton, Indiana congressman, and then Tom Keene, the governor, former Republican governor of New Jersey, named. And so $3 million was given for the inquiry. Contrast that with the nearly $60, $70 million spent in the 1990s on the Clintons for Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky. And even the New York Times and a couple other major papers complained in the spring of 2003, as the inquiry got off, that the government was trying to starve the 9/11 Commission for funding to do a proper job. So these people got together, and they began to meet. The dozen members of the Family Steering Committee started meeting with the 10 9/11 commissioners. They had about 50 press releases during the length of that 9/11 commission, which went for over a year and a half. Kristen Breitwiser writes in her memoir, Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow, that they met with Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton. And Lee Hamilton, who'd been on the Iran-Contra inquiry in the late 80s, early 90s, was not supportive of having any public hearings. He thought that they would be dangerous. He didn't want to have anybody swearing under oath, no subpoenas. And so a number of the family members thinking, well, what's going on here? We want to have an investigation, get to the root of what happened here to make the nation safe. You can't have an inquiry if you never subpoena anyone for information. So there were some more red flags there. And by September of 2003, the families issued a report card on how the commission was doing after 9 months and decried the only one subpoena that had been issued to all the different agencies. And they also were concerned that there were witnesses that were coming from different agencies before there's public hearings, but there's also private meetings behind closed doors with 8 or 9 of the teams of the 80 staff for the 9/11 commission. And the families learned that you'd have somebody who's with the FBI or with the CIA or with the Department of Defense or the FAA, and they're coming to speak before either the 9/11 commissioners or one of the staff teams doing the investigation. And what would happen is you've got the witness there to answer questions, but they have someone higher up with them now who's a government minder. And that person might have their hand on the witness's shoulder, or they might be sitting right beside them, non-verbally giving them a cue about what to answer or not answer. And in some cases, the families learned and other staff teams reported and complained to the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission that you'd somehow have a question asked of a witness and the government minder beside them, who was higher up, senior to them in the department, would answer the question, interrupt the witness and answer the question instead. So this is part of what's going on with the commission.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Now let's take a look at something that is rarely, if ever, discussed, and that is go through the testimony of individuals who weren't allowed to give official testimony, but shared what they saw and experienced firsthand that would contradict the media and the government's official positions.
Yes, there were whistleblowers that were coming up to the family members on the family steering committee and saying, "Would you please have the 9/11 Commission subpoena us because we need the protection of a subpoena so that we won't have any retribution if we after we testified." But one of the people that came to Patty Casaza, whose husband John died in the North Tower, was a person from the FBI and FBI translator, Sibel Edmonds. And Patty and a couple of the others just brought Sibel right in with them when they were having a meeting, a scheduled meeting with the 9/11 commissioners, and said, "You have to interview her." And so Sibel Edmonds was interviewed for about 3 hours. And during her testimony, which could possibly be refuted by somebody else in the government, but her testimony, as Patty shares it, was that Sibel told the commissioners that the government knew ahead of time the date that the attacks would happen, the method of the attacks, planes, and the targets, being the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And that's a powerful testimony and certainly a way off message from the official story that it was a huge surprise. So that testimony was given, but it was omitted from the report. Another person who testified was William Rodriguez, a janitor who worked in the World Trade Center. And he was, forget which tower, it might have been the North Tower, but he was down 3 or 4 or 5 floors below the lobby in the basement and sub-basement. And there was a huge explosion, as he recounts it, just before, in the North Tower, because just before the plane hit the North Tower at 8:46 a.m. And there were, screaming, and another guy came in named Philippe David, who was, his whole face was burned, and he was yelling, "Explosion, explosion." He'd been working with a little machine to put, potato chips and other things into the vending machines, or getting ready to do things like that. And so that, William Rodriguez was also involved in rescuing numbers of people and talked about hearing more explosions in the next, half an hour to 45 minutes. And he went to testify before the 9/11 commission as well. And he told them about what he had experienced. He told them that there was another, 14 people that he wanted to bring with him. I don't at this minute remember whether or not he brought them with him or said he wanted to. But in any case, they were all willing to also testify. His testimony was also omitted from the 9/11 Commission report. And it was, shocking for both of those people, William Rodriguez and Sibel Edmonds, to give their testimony and find it nowhere reflected in the 9/11 Commission report.
But there are more than just two. You have an opportunity now to look. Here's what's important. Share what you know from your research that can be independently verified, that the commission did not want to hear, would not allow to be heard, but the American public, the worldwide public right now, is listening to you. So open the door and let this out, all right?
Yeah. But one of the things that's important framework to understand what was going on with the commission was that they had Philip Zelikow, who was named as the executive director. And he had co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice, the national security advisor. He also had written the paper policy for preemptive war and the whole effort to go into Iraq. And so the families learned about this and were shocked and wanted him to resign, but he was told to stay on. But in I think March, before the first public hearing in March of 2003, Philip Zelikow and another person named Ernst May wrote the outline for the whole 9/11 Commission report, the chapter headings and the subheadings. And this was Bob McElvain, whose family story has been recently featured in a September Atlantic Monthly of this year, said that it was outrageous that the whole outline for what the investigation would be was already put together before they began to investigate. Because normally what you do with an investigation is you start to ask questions, you ask certain witnesses to come forward. And sometimes there's new information that's shared in that testimony, and it can take an investigation in a whole new direction. We've often seen this in courtroom dramas, where a star witness suddenly brings something forth, and then there's a whole new side to the investigation. But looking at the 9/11 Commission report, when it was published, all the chapter headings and the subheadings almost word for word were paraphrased or exactly the same. And so you have Philip Zelikow, who's the only person who really knows what, where he's steering this thing. And it was, so this outline is put together in March of 2003. In the spring of 2004, I think around May, it's leaked out, because in March of 2003, Zelikow and senior counsel Ernst May, plus Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton, the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, agreed that they would keep this outline secret. So none of the other 9/11 commissioners knew about the outline, the Family Steering Committee didn't know, and neither did any of the other 80 9/11 Commission staff. So when this came out in the spring of 2004, some of the staff wrote anonymously a parody talking about magic bullets, kind of referring back to the JFK assassination only looking for the evidence you want to, or cooking it up. And so that's what's going on. One of the things that the families asked was a question about why did World Trade Building 7 47-tower building collapse, you know, into dust in less than 7 seconds at 5:20 p.m. in the evening, many hours later, not hit by a plane. And that question that they asked was never even addressed. It would seem to be important because the 47-tower building is just, you know, it's a huge building, and for it to just crumble into ground. I mean, Monica Gabrielle, whose husband Richard died in the South Tower, said, how can buildings just crumble into the ground in seconds? And so the families, you know, had questions about that. There's been a lot of, you know, back and forth over the years. The National Institutes of Standards and Technologies talked about things like, well, maybe there was a fire in a boiler room or something. But architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, representing over 3,000 architects and engineers, have raised serious questions about the modeling and everything that goes into the NIST reports. And in 2010, four of the former Family Steering Committee members, Monica Gabrielle, Lori Van Auken, Patty Casaza, and Mindy Kleinberg, jointly issued a press release with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, asking the government to have a new investigation into the collapse of the Twin Towers and the World Trade Center 7. Of course, there's been nothing. And significantly, in 2019 or 20, the University of Alaska Fairbanks issued their 4-year report on a paper about the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, and said that the collapse, as it's described in the NIST report, simply is impossible. There's no way, with their modeling and assumptions behind that, that could have happened. Another question that the families asked in relation to this whole topic is reports of explosions in the buildings. Patty Casaza's husband, John, saying "I love you, goodbye" in their phone call, he said that he was hearing bombs going off in the upper floors of the North Tower. He happened to mention it, and other of his colleagues were hearing it too. So that stayed with her, and she was one of the ones who, I think, wanted the Family Steering Committee to ask the 9/11 Commission just to find out what about reports of explosions in the buildings. The 9/11 Commission didn't address that question. It happens that in the fall of 2001 into 2002, the Fire Department of New York interviewed 503 first responders, the firefighters and EMTs that went in there, the heroes of 9/11, to rescue people and save lives. And of those 503 first responders, about 118 of them volunteered information during their testimony. Testimony often not just with senior fire department officials, but often with the FBI present. They would volunteer that during their efforts to rescue people in the World Trade Center towers, that they variously heard what they described as either bombs, explosions, secondary devices going off. And so it was very specific, the kind of information that they were sharing. And so like just one example of this would be firefighter John Coyle. He was in the South Tower, and he was interviewed, and he recalled how he was certain about explosions all around him, and he called his father to let him know what happened. And he says in his testimony, "I finally got through to my father and said, 'I'm alive. I just wanted to tell you to go to church. I'm alive. I just so narrowly escaped this thing,' he said. Where were you? You were there?" Father says to John Coyle. And Coyle says, "Yeah, I was right there when it blew up." His father says, "You were there when the planes hit?" Coyle says to his dad, "No, I was there when it exploded. The building exploded." Coyle said, No, his father says, "You mean when it fell down?" Coyle says back to his father, "No, when it exploded. I totally thought it had been blown up. That's just the perspective of it looking at it. It seemed to have exploded out and up." Firefighter Thomas Spinard talks about pulling right up, in quote, right in front of the building. And he recalled, "We had two civilians blown out to the middle of the West Street on the divider. They were just blown up there." So you've got people, you know, in the building, and then suddenly they're blown across the street to the boulevard. Another one remembers seeing William Reynolds remembers a large explosion in the South Tower and seeing fire shooting out a couple hundred feet in each direction. So you've got, you know, other firefighters talking about, I was on the 23rd floor and I was, and then there was an explosion and I was blown 40 feet across the lobby or across the floor. So the details are very specific, and it might be that if just one or two firefighters had an impression of what they thought was an explosion, that they were volunteering to describe to their senior staff in the Fire Department of New York, it might be, you know, discounted. But when you have 118 of these people, of these first responders describing things, you know, the picture that emerges of the collective 118 testimonies is very compelling to suggest that there were, in fact, bombs in those buildings. Question could be asked, the 9/11 Commission could ask, you know, well, who planted bombs in the building? But that's not a question that they ever looked into. And the 9/11 Commission knew about this testimony. The FBI was sitting present to many of these interviews with the firefighters and EMTs. And so it wasn't as though the 9/11 Commission was unaware. They did know. But yet they didn't, you know, they should have asked 503 first responders who happened to testify before the Fire Department of New York. They should have brought them in as witnesses. But it seems hardly anyone went in as a witness who was a firefighter. So this just raises huge questions about what happened for the families. The testimony that I'm talking about, referring to, that happened, that was taken in the fall and winter of 2001-2002, there were numbers of family members. I don't know if they were different from the family steering committee itself, but there might be some overlap, but other families as well, because there are many thousands of people affected by this, together with the New York Times, sued the city of New York to release the testimony of these 503 first responders. And that was successful. And on the 12th of August, 2005, the New York Times had a little article about this in the print edition and then posted online. It's still there today. The 503 testimonies, all alphabetical, starting with the letter A. And if you want to, you can do what I did some years ago, which was to simply, as a discipline, read one firefighter's testimony a day for 503 days in a row. It's about 16 and a half months it'll take. But it's very interesting to read and gripping and, you know, difficult material. But it's important. And it was ignored by the 9/11 Commission.
Of course it was. My final question is simple. You note that 70% of the family's committee's questions were left unanswered, and then the answers for some of the others created even more questions or were discerned to be nothing but lies. Perhaps it would be helpful to briefly summarize the more important of the salient questions the Family Steering Committee sought to have answered beyond the testimony you just mentioned. For example, can you speak about the 9/11 issue and Saudi Arabian involvement, especially now that Biden has said, well, I'm going to release papers? Does any reasonable person believe that anything the government would release at this time that would be in any way showing complicity by royals would have been scrubbed, destroyed? So they're just going to release something that's sanitized, that doesn't show anything that makes it a policy that we cannot support a terrorist nation or that was complicit in this terrorist attack against the United States.
it's such an interesting story about this, the Saudis. The families wanted, one of their questions, we wanted to the government to release the 28 redacted pages, which were part of what was entered in the joint 9/11 Congress and Senate. There were people who were able to read that behind closed doors, but it wasn't ever part of the 9/11 Commission at all. And so the families are saying, well, you know, the government story is 15 of 19 hijackers are from Saudi Arabia. So is there a connection here? And it seems that there's a lot of strange stuff going on. You have suddenly a Visa Express program put into place. The U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia, State Department people, I think Michael Springman was a whistleblower about this, that there were people together with the State Department and who were from the CIA, and they were you know, the State Department was saying, you know, we've got some real questions about some of these visa applicants, and we want to, you know, slow walk this and do, you know, or just out and out reject these applications. But the CIA staffers there, Michael and Casey and others, were saying, no, we're gonna fast track this. And these are visa applications where you have people putting down, you know, what year were you born? Answer, 1878. What will you be doing when you come to America? No reply. Who are you staying with? I don't know. I mean, any one of us, imagine filling out a visa application to go to a country in the world that you might want to visit that requires a visa, and filling out an application with these kinds of non-answers and leaving much of your application blank. You wouldn't get to go to that other country. But it seems that there were some CIA staffers that were very happy to get these people with poorly filled, incomplete visa forms to get to America as soon as they could. So there's a question about this: what is the reason after all these years that the United States government has been so involved in shielding, it seems, on the part of the families, any investigation? The families have wanted to, I guess it's 1,800 families that signed a petition recently telling President Biden, don't show up on September 11th memorials unless you've released released something or promising to release more. But they've wanted to have a day in court with the Saudi Arabian government to explore complicity. And yet you have, as recently, I remember reading, I think in 2018-19, under Trump's administration, you've got Attorney General William Barr going to the judge, and they're saying, we cannot have any of this, these classified documents, in a trial, because it would breach state secrets and would harm the national security of the American government. And the families are saying, in what way would revealing a story about possible Saudi Arabian complicity in the attack to September 11th harm the national security of the American government, of our government? I mean, what state secrets would be breached? And it seems that for some families, I think talking with Bob McElvain, his son Bobby died, and Joe Krakenfels, who's down in Florida, whose nephew Leonard Snyder died, they think that if some of the information were to come out that was not scrubbed and polished so to look nice for the general public, but if you could see the raw data that possible Saudi complicity could point to possible U.S. government complicity. So that might explain why there's been such resistance to have any, you know, or it could be different, that there could be something that some people in the Saudi Arabian government or intelligence agencies has some dirt, so to speak, on the U.S. Government or U.S. intelligence agency. So it's, that's all part of what that story is ending up at 20 years later. You've got many families that are just beside themselves that this has gone on for so long, and that they, you know, Monica
Ray,
Gabrielle.
No one should believe anything involving the government's report. The last question is that there's a lot of confusion and miscommunication, we're told, within NORAD and airline controllers that prevented any kind of response even before the tower strikes. Now, we've been told that there's nothing we could have done to prevent those strikes. Could you give us any more understanding to remove some of this confusion and miscommunication answers they've given us?
Yes. It's a question that I had to research, because I never talked about scrambling. All I ever scrambled were eggs. I mean, I didn't know what scrambling jets was, and so I had to look. And way back in 1956, there was the mid-air Grand Canyon collision with a commercial flight and a military plane. 128 people died, and there were a couple of other collisions with planes going through clouds and bad weather out in New Jersey and Connecticut, Pennsylvania in the late 50s. And so the forerunner to the Federal Aviation Administration back in 1958 was formed, and they put in place things that are familiar to us, because at the time that you have these crashes going on up in the sky in 56, 57, 58, the traveling public wants to be reassured that if they buy a ticket and get on a plane and fly somewhere across domestic U.S. airspace, that they can be assured that their plane will not crash into another plane up in the sky. A reasonable expectation. And so now you have protocols where the pilots at the departure gate have to be in touch with the air traffic control and have an approved flight path and an approved altitude. And so the consequence of veering off more than 2 miles off of that approved flight path or altitude, you know, I've been on in planes, I'm sure you may have too, where you're in a, you know, in a plane, now there's some rough turbulence, or there's a thunderstorm, and now the plane has to reroute itself a bit, and they have to get permission again from the nearest air traffic control tower to change their altitude up by 1,000 or down by 1,000, or go a bit to the left or right of where they were going. If they don't get that permission, what happens, the protocols were, that a plane flying off course up in the air, typically with maybe 4,000 other planes flying up in the air, constitutes a real and present danger to all of the other planes flying in the opposite direction. This makes sense. It's common sense. And so the U.S. Air Force is to scramble jets to intercept the plane that's off course, to initially just tip the wings and make sure everything's okay and put them back on their proper trajectory. Or if there's something more serious going on with the with what's in the cockpit, sick pilots, hijacking, you know, try and take the plane down to the nearest airport and deal with the situation. There's a number of times where there were even hijackings going on, and the plane would fly down with a military escort to the nearest airport. So this is supposed to happen. on September 11th. And it's not because the U.S. Air Force in the year 2001, that there weren't pilots that were training for this. You have General Accounting Office reports that come out every year to Congress. And they're letting the Congress know how much it costs for all of the military flights that have been scrambled to intercept planes off course during the calendar year. I remember reading a GAO report in 1993, I think, about all of the flights by military jets in 1989, 90, 91, and 92. And it was over 1,500 occasions where they flew. And it's important to understand that it's not like this is a baseball team where they're, you know, batting, you know, one out of two or two out of three. They're scrambling and intercepting with military precision 100% of the time all of the requests from the FAA to go and intercept those planes that are off course. The families remembered that Payne Stewart, a golfer, had been flying a private plane, a small plane, in Florida, and his plane went off course, and suddenly there were six military jets escorting him down to the nearest runway. So they wanted to know. I mean, when Mindy Kleinberg says, whose husband Alan died, says, so what happened on September 11th? How come we're zero for four when you have such a sterling, flawless track record from 1958 until the 10th of September? So it just didn't make any sense for the families at all. Lori Van Auken has said that there are two protocols in particular. There's one about the emergency response, which is the moment that the plane flies 2 miles off course, it's posing a danger. And so right away, that should have initiated the protocol to intercept the plane. And then secondly, and those planes were flying wildly off course for nearly 2 hours altogether. And then you also have the hijack protocols, which is separate, which also should have sent military jets up to do things. And you can have, you know, these jets, if you've ever been to an air show, can do all kinds of buzzing around and flying around. You know, even if you have a determined hijacking pilot, if this is the case, flying a plane, because they've never flown a plane before, but anyway, if they're doing something, you can still have the plane, the military fighter pilots can buzz around and distract the plane and throw it off its course, you know, heading into a Twin Towers. So, or the Pentagon, most importantly. And so it's just incredible to the families that there could be no military response at all. And people who were family members that had military family, you know, in their family, either who died or who were in the military, said that this is preposterous. It cannot have happened that way. And when the NORAD generals testified before the 9/11 commission, you have reports, everything from earlier on, General Myers saying to the press, well, we didn't scramble any jets at all. There was no military response. And then you have testimony from the various different generals, which is seven different, completely incompatible explanations for what happened. And it was so shocking to the 9/11 commissioners that they did seriously consider asking the Department of Justice to criminally investigate the Pentagon and NORAD.
Nothing happened. So, you've given us to think. Nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
It's just, and nothing will happen, ever. That's the way the system works. It's just as important for you to come on today and just share some of the contradictions of the official story. What is revealing to me is simple, that in all this time, with all the major media and all of its resources, there has not been one single major media that has had the courage to do its own independent investigation to share this with the world. Not one. But these are the same people who never found any contradictions in the Sirhan killing of Robert Kennedy Jr. or JFK or Martin Luther King or any of the major crises. They all work together. And we shouldn't be angry about it. It's become common. that our government does not tell us the truth when we need it. But you have, and I appreciate you taking your time, coming on today, and sharing your insights from many years of research. Ray, going into the final part of our question period here, and I just want to mention to those who have just come on board that my guest is Ray McInnes. He is an author and private researcher living in British Columbia, and he's looking into questions that have not been answered, or not answered honestly, or ignored, about 9/11. And he's looked carefully and deeply at all this. So, Ray, let's begin with, this was the 20th anniversary. Interestingly, there's been a flurry of articles and conversations combining a review of 9/11, but in the context of the COVID pandemic, I originally considered this odd because it would dumb down the importance and even the progress made so far in the independent 9/11 research. However, perhaps there's another story, because if the attack on the towers was either something that was permitted to happen, a hypothesis, with foreknowledge, or factions within the government were directly involved in this operation, again, not proven, then simply killing innocent Americans and ruining the lives of thousands of others callously for a political and or strategic goal should raise concerns about how truthful elements within the government is about the pandemic and the deeper purpose behind the policies being enacted to confront it. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that's the case. It is merely a hypothesis that has been proffered by different people. Or whether there is another larger goal in mind, and the pandemic is simply a vehicle to reach that goal. Now, I'm asking you, do you have any thoughts on this for the following reason? When you look at all the evidence that is presented in the 9/11 final report, and how sternly every single media has kept to, there's nothing beyond that. That is the full truth. All the evidence is in. There was no conspiracy, no government agency, no rogue agents. And they have then to dismiss all of the counterbalancing weight that there was a lot more that could have been included. All the testimony you mentioned about the people hearing bombs actually being blown up in the basement, a door blew against them before the planes hit. And the man down there had to get another colleague and drag him out of the building, and they only survived, I understand, because they went under a car. Well, how do you dismiss all of those people who are first responders who have experience in the field? And all that is completely dismissed. There's just, in my opinion, there are too many contradictions to the official opinion simply to accept it as the first and last and authoritative word on the topic. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, it would seem that the 9/11 Commission was aware that in the fall and winter of 2001, that 503 first responders of the Fire Department of New York, most firefighters and some EMTs, did give their oral testimony to their higher-ups, often with the FBI present. And of those 118, in their own words, volunteered in the course of their recounting what they did to rescue people, mentioned on their own behalf experiencing bombs, secondary devices, or explosions, as they described it. So it would seem that if you're a firefighter and you've had a lot, you know, 343 of your colleagues in the Fire Department of New York have died, and you're speaking about this dreadful, traumatic experience as a first responder before your superiors and with the FBI likely also present, it would seem that it would be highly likely that the firefighter in question would be telling a trustworthy account of what they experienced. And when you put 118 of these together testifying in the same manner, it seems that testimony should have been before the 9/11 Commission, because they knew about it, because the FBI knew about it, but they ignored it. So it causes, you know, the families. I mean, the family members just want to know, what about that? I mean, either there are a massive breach of security failure where there somehow are terrorists that are breaching of the World Trade Center and planting bombs or something, or else there's other people who are involved, either in private companies or within the government itself, is what they come up with. So an investigation would properly have looked into those things. So it creates, for Monica Gabrielle, whose husband Richard died in the South Tower, in the 2006 documentary 9/11 Press for Truth about the Family Steering Committee's efforts, she was saying that, she accepted the story of the 19 hijackers, but had many problems with what the government had done in the 9/11 Commission inquiry and found great fault with it. In 2007, in the anniversary, she is interviewed by the Hartford Courant, and she's saying at that point that she is dismayed by what she's learning and is far more distrustful of the official account. And then in the following few years, she endorses a book by David Ray Griffin, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, where he puts forward a thesis that there could be, people involved in different agencies in the American government themselves that either had foreknowledge and sat on their hands or helped in some way the attacks. And I think it's significant to have a Family Steering Committee member, Monica Gabrielle, actually endorse a book like that that raises a whole bunch of deeper and even more disturbing questions. And so I think that for some numbers of families are content with the official account. And then there are others that have lingering doubts and serious questions about that account, which raises questions about the trustworthiness of government statements in general, including I have no idea what any of the family members think about the current pandemic, although I do know one person, Joe Krakenfels, whose nephew Leonard Snyder died in the World Trade Center, and he's very skeptical of the official COVID narrative.
Okay, let's pause that thought for a moment. Why? Because we have just learned from multiple sources that for 4 years, all of the media, virtually all of it, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, all of the talking heads, hundreds upon hundreds that we see proffering their opinions as so-called experts, all said that the last election, and I do not support Trump on any level, but that he was only elected because of Russian interference. Everything was Russia, Russia, Russia. Adam Schiff and his committee, and he was the head of the Intelligence Committee, said he had absolute information. He never provided it. Now we know that after four separate independent investigations, all with top government officials, they didn't find an iota of truth to that, which meant that they all were lying by intent. Now, then you start to look, and Glenn Greenwald did this, Matt Taibbi did this, Max Blumenthal at the Gray Zone did this. They looked deeper and found out that it was the deep state, mainly the CIA and the National Security Agency, that were lying. And indeed, the head of both lied under oath, but were not held accountable. So we have the deep state in the last 4 years lying. We have all the major media supporting those lies, where they could have easily found the same information that these investigative reporters, who used to be the darlings within their media, you would see on a weekly basis, you would see the Jonathan Turleys, the constitutional lawyer, you would see Matt Taibbi, you would see Glenn Greenwald all the time. Now, you don't see any of them. You don't see about 30 different journalists, because even though they did not support Trump, they do not support lies. So if they were lying constantly in unison, then it's understandable that many people within the administration may have lied about different aspects of the 9/11 hearings and evidence. Is it not a reasonable hypothesis? Especially since our media utterly ignores the family's efforts, not just to limit to the Bush presidential years, but also they continue through the Obama and Trump and even now Biden administration as well as during the years of three New York City mayors, Giuliani, Bloomberg, and de Blasio, and aside from the release of those pages concerning Saudi Arabia, there is still a resounding silence. Has any other progress really been made during the latter administration on questions that were pushed aside during the Bush era? Your thoughts on both of those, please.
Well, I think that, you know, it's astonishing and stupefying, and people like Kristen Breitweiser and Lori Van Auken have said to a reporter in Vermont in 2009 that they were suffering from what they called a post-traumatic betrayal syndrome, PTBS. And in 2020, it's I think William Barr, Attorney General for Trump, is telling a judge regarding families of the September 11th victims who want to have a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia for possible complicity, that all of these documents cannot be made public because it would harm state secrets and would also damage American national security. And the families are thinking, well, how could our proceeding with a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, if they are complicit, I mean, a judge would have to decide, if they are complicit, how would a guilty verdict regarding Saudi Arabia harm American national security? It's just, it raises questions for some members. They wonder, well, is there something that the Saudis' intelligence knows about American intelligence? With, you know, is there something that points the finger back at the USA? So it raises questions about the behavior of four administrations or three administrations just stonewalling the families regarding Saudi Arabia. And I think that over history, I see a parallel, Robert Stinnett's Day of Deceit, which talks about the Pearl Harbor attacks. And quickly there was an investigation finding the naval commanders out in Hawaii, you know, dereliction of duty, and they, you know, were, they had, they were sort of the scapegoats. But over the years, the mid 1990s, there was finally 4,000 or more memorandums and communications between different intercepts of the people tracking the Japanese, decoding the Japanese in the American military. And the families of the descendants of those commanders, Kimmel and Short, brought to the U.S. Senate a strong case to say that their commanders should be exonerated, because although Hawaii was not aware of a Japanese attack, Washington, D.C. was. And so they had all of this information, and a Senate vote happened in 1998 or 99. In favor of exonerating them, but President Clinton let the resolution sit on his desk and expire. So, for those that know that history, it raises the question of a long history of deception or ignoring of pertinent information that could write a different history if we knew it.
My final quick thought, and then a closing quick thought from you, please, is that we saw how the FBI was absolutely complicit in covering up the crimes and misdemeanors of Hillary Clinton and her server. Any other citizen of the United States, public official, corporate leader who did the same as she would have gone to prison or been indicted. But Comey ran interference, and now we have seen how Comey and his White House actively engaged in all of the mess involving lies and distortion of the Trump dossier. And again, it is no support of Trump. I don't support Trump. But why should we believe or trust any of these officials and any of these agencies when they have such a nefarious and corrupted background? Final thought from you, please.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, of Saudi Arabia, and you have people in the State Department, in the U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia, laterally blowing the whistle, Michael Stringman, and talking about how you have, you know, 15 hijackers with visas to come to the United States, and the applications are incomplete. Where are they going? You know, where are you staying? What are you studying? No answer. What year were you born? 1878. If any one of us filled out visas like that to go to a country requiring a visa, we'd never get there. But people in the CIA, adjacent to the State Department, to the state embassy, the U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia, overrule the State Department staffers at the embassy and fast-track through a Visa Express those very people that ended up being accused, alleged to be involved behind it. So it just seems, you know, that agencies are doing exactly the opposite of what you think that they would do. You know, bad judgment, okay. but maybe much worse. And so for the families, it's it leaves them with these questions that still are as pertinent to be explored as they were 20 years ago.
Ray McGinnis, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.